From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief, Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and here are the issues. Negotiators on curbing Iran's nuclear program may fail to meet the June 30 deadline to reach a deal and be forced to extend the talks. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei appeared to scale back parts already agreed on in a possible nuclear pact. American Defense Secretary Ash Carter unveiled a plan to base 250 tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, and artillery pieces across six Eastern European countries. Russian officials criticized the move. And in the United States, President Obama won two important victories on trade. Votes in Congress assured ultimate passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a treaty involving the U.S., Japan, and 10 other countries. And the Supreme Court upheld the government's power to provide health insurance subsidies in all 50 states. The ruling is likely to intensify the debate over the health care program in the 2016 presidential campaign. Well, David, I'm going to start with you. What is the Supreme Leader up to in Iran?
If I knew what the Supreme Leader was up to for sure, then I'd be taken straight to the Oval Office to tell President Obama, because everyone would like to know. Basically, to unpack your intro, it is true that we look like we're going to miss the June 30th deadline, but that may well be good news, because there was certainly a concern by some allies that if you went into these talks saying that that was a hard deadline, then it looked like you were going to do a bad deal to hit it. And so you saw some people actually telling openly, Secretary John Kerry and the others, let the deadline slip if you have to. Don't seem to need this deal more than they do. Clearly, the Supreme Leader has grave concerns about the whole bigger picture, more than just the nuclear story. So we saw some very interesting reporting this week in the Financial Times, quoting senior Iranian politicians who had been to a meeting with the Supreme Leader, where he talked about something that's very important on the Western side, which is having intrusive inspections of non-nuclear military sites, missile sites and stuff. The Supreme Leader was remembering the years when Iraq, during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, remembering when Iraq had missiles and Iran did not, and Iran had to beg other countries for missiles to defend itself. And he told these Iranian politicians, you know, we can never go back to that world. It's very important for our national security to have our own missiles. Therefore, we cannot possibly allow these foreigners to walk around our missile sites. And so you can see, assuming that reporting is accurate, and it was pretty credible, this is such a sort of gigantic question mark about what kind of state he wants to be. It's not just a discussion about nuclear weapons. It's about the Supreme Leader's own sense of the sort of existential survival of Iran and whether this deal threatens that.
Without making John Kerry sound like he was doing propaganda for the Obama administration, but he did say that Khamenei said what he said because he was basically talking to a domestic audience in Iran. And I'm quite inclined to believe that. Part of what Khamenei does as the supreme leader of the revolution in Iran is that he is basically a power broker between the various factions within the Iranian state. And there has been a lot of pressure from conservative hardliners in Iran saying that this is not a good deal that the Iranian negotiating team is trying to knock out with the Americans and the others. So he is trying to echo that. Having said that, for him to just satisfy the pressures of the conservatives is not enough to explain why he's trying to basically push something that was supposed to happen by the end of the month further into the future. But let me just say this. David mentioned Iraq. The Iranians have a great deal of experience to fall back on from inspections in Iraq. When Saddam refused access to international inspectors, to military sites, to presidential sites, we all know what happened at the end in terms of relations with the United States and the toppling of Saddam and so on. So I'm sure the Iranians are keeping that in mind, given that they are much more stringent about their sovereignty than Saddam could have possibly have been.
Yeah, David, doesn't this make the whole Iranian nuclear question tougher for President Obama?
Well, he's on the brink of an extraordinary moment in his presidency. I mean, either he's going to do a deal which people nervously and skeptically and grudgingly accept is an extraordinary moment in history where he has put a nuclear threat much further away than it had been before, not eliminated it, or he's in real trouble because he has a deal that is not going to get through Congress, which allies are going to start picking at. And it is clear that already what we think is on the table, given the reporting, is, you know, there are more concessions have been made than people would like. And we saw this rather interesting development this week with some of his closest former advisors, people who served in his first term and even some in his second term, who wrote this joint letter setting out some of their concerns, some of their kind of, I mean, red lines is an awful phrase, that they didn't want him to cross. And they're right that if you look at what the administration itself said was a good deal at the beginning of this process, they have made some big concessions.
Yeah, his former advisors were saying the president should insist on things that it appears the Supreme Leader specifically doesn't want, things like snap inspections of Iran's nuclear and military sites. I'm reading from a piece in the Wall Street Journal here. Resolution of questions surrounding secretly developed nuclear weapons technologies and a phased-in reduction of ending sanctions. And, of course, the Ayatollah, the Supreme Leader, is saying, no, when we sign a deal, we want all sanctions to be gone immediately.
Well, we're stuck in the same position, aren't we? Which is, what is the alternative to doing this deal right now? And clearly, you don't want to do a deal so terrible it's just a path to a nuclear bomb. But most people, there is a kind of consensus, I think, even within Congress. You know, there is not a war party, to make this sort of simple. There is not a majority anywhere, not in Congress, not even, I think, in the Republican Party, to go to war with Iran. So people want a deal. They're just very, very concerned at this last minute that concessions are being made that will make this deal sort of meaningless.
You know, all these former advisors, I know some of them, Dennis Ross in particular, of President Obama, Abdi, what they're insisting on are things that are going to be very hard to get, I think, from the Iranians.
I totally agree with that. And given that neither the Obama administration nor the Iranians have anywhere else to go, having reached this point in the negotiations. Look, the issue of sanctions, when you start easing the sanctions, I think, despite what Khamenei said, I think that he left wiggling room, and we could see concessions from the Iranian side on that. But the issue of inspections, what should be allowed, which sites should be allowed to be inspected, I think that's going to be much more of a sticking point. But regardless of what happens, the Iranians do have the know-how now. They do have the brains. And as we'd seen in the case of Iraq in the past, unless you're actually prepared to go into Iran and get those brains out, that expertise will stay in Iranian hands regardless of whether you have an agreement for 10 years or 15 years down the road.
I suspect we all agree, and I want to get to another issue, but one way or another, Iran is going to be a nuclear power, whether there's a deal and after the deal expires in 10 or 15 years, however long it is, or even sooner.
I think one interesting objection you hear from people like the French, although they're not probably going to push this to the end, is we're creating a new class of threshold nuclear powers. There's now a new club of countries that are quite close to a nuclear weapon.
David, let me stop you there because we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fakhara, Washington Bureau Chief, Al Jazeera Satellite TV. David, I interrupted you, so please continue.
So we have a problem that countries have identified, including France. If you look at what Iran is going to walk away with, assuming this deal happens, they're essentially a short distance away from being able to start building a nuclear bomb. As Abdurrahim says correctly, their scientists have this knowledge. And we're sort of allowing them to be at that point. There's a fear that we're creating a new category of threshold nuclear states. And some countries worry that others will then immediately say, well, we want to be in that club too. And so it's interesting, there was a visiting government minister from another country here this week talking about Japan, you know, whether the Japanese are looking much more aggressive on their sort of ambitions to be that much closer to a nuclear weapon. There's a sense that proliferation is not going to be where President Obama wanted it to be at the end of this deal.
Okay, let's turn to this question of a very small contingent of forces and equipment in NATO sticking in these six Eastern European countries that feel threatened by Russia. But, Abdi, it wasn't that long ago when, well, maybe it's been 20, 25 years, when America had 400,000 troops American troops in Europe. Now, what do we have, 40,000 or something like that, something in the neighborhood of that. Anyway, it's not that many. And this would be some equipment, sort of a pre-base there. And yet the Russians responded very, very unhappily. In fact, General Yuri Yakubov says, this would be the most aggressive step by the Pentagon and NATO since the Cold War of the last century. I mean, this is from the Russians who have invaded Ukraine and taken Crimea.
Absolutely. The phrase Cold War is obviously being tossed around both in Russia and here in Washington. Have we returned to the Cold War? And in many ways, yeah, the spirit of the Cold War is alive, certainly between Washington and Moscow. But, you know, this circles back to the issue of Iran, for example. Mm-hmm. What happens if you take a certain course of action with the Iranians, given how invested the Russians are in Iran, not just in Ukraine and Syria and elsewhere, particularly in Iran's nuclear issue. But for Vladimir Putin to actually make the noises that he's been making over recent days, going so far as to allude to the possibility of a nuclear strike if the US and the West, NATO, continue to deploy on the scale that we that they are talking about in the Baltic region, I think it just leads you to take the phrase Cold War a little bit more seriously than we have been discussing in recent months.
I couldn't agree more, David.
I think we need to be clear about what these 250 tanks and bits of heavy armor are doing. Clearly, 250 tanks, that's not how you invade Russia. We're back to the old Cold War doctrine of a tripwire. Mm-hmm. You put American uniforms near the border, and that means that any Russian attempt to send, you know, troops with no badges, the little green men, they will come up against American troops, and that changes everything. And so you have seen Eastern European governments particularly from former Soviet bloc countries like the Baltic states, which emerged from the Soviet Union to regain their independence when the Soviet Union collapsed. They have been very keen for a long time to have actual American troops stationed in their countries. You saw the Poles very keen at one moment to be part of a missile defense scheme so that they could have an American crew in uniform on their soil, because there was a sense that nothing is quite as good a guarantee that America will come in and intervene as having American troops on your soil. So that Russia knows that if it starts messing around in your sovereign territory, it's going to bump into Americans pretty soon. And one tragic reason that this is so important is Europe itself, the European side of NATO, is not actually that firm in its support politically. Governments are, but we saw a very troubling opinion poll the other day from Pew Research. They asked European citizens, if there was an armed attack on another bit of NATO, would you want to use military force to respond? And majorities in countries like France and Italy said no.
So who is pushing this positioning of equipment and some troops? A small number. I mean, as you say, this is not an invasion force. Is it the Obama administration?
Yeah, I think that what you hear when you talk to people, I mean, I've spoken quite a lot to sort of senior officials about this over the last several months. What they say is that President Obama, he's attacked when it comes to, say, Syria policy for being incredibly reluctant, incredibly cautious, incredibly skeptical that military force is the way to go. But leave that on one side, he is, among other things, a lawyer, and he takes legal obligations and treaty obligations extremely seriously. And NATO is a legal obligation. An attack on one member of NATO under Article 5 is an attack on all. If you have that kind of treaty guarantee from the United States, President Obama believes that it is a vital national security interest of the United States to be seen as standing behind those formal legal guarantees. So this is an area in which, although he's hardly gung-ho, he has been, you know, from the start, you know, mm-hmm. he has been rotating units, training units, supposedly, through these Baltic republics. We've seen more air patrols. You know, America has been, frankly, the only assertive player in a lot of these scenarios in the last few months.
You know, David cited this Pew poll, and Europeans may be squishy, but I wonder whether Vladimir Putin understands exactly what David was saying, that this is a deep obligation through NATO that America has. I haven't seen a poll on it, but I would think that Americans would be more favorable toward this than the Europeans appeared to be in the Pew poll.
I'm sure he understands that. He, I'm sure, also understands that the commitment to the notion that one attack against one NATO country is an attack on all NATO countries, that commitment has been selective. I mean, a small but significant example, when Turkey comes under attack from the Syria, and it did come under attack from the Syrian side in the past, mm-hmm. and the Turks felt very jittery, and they were looking around Europe, well, should we respond to this as a member of NATO? Well, the support they got on that wasn't terribly strong, and I'm sure that Putin understands that. I think the other thing that I'm sure he also understands, and which David alluded to, is that Europeans, not governments, the peoples of Europe, they are aware and willing to exercise economic muscles. But gone are the days, you know, this is a continent that's gone through two terrible world wars. And Europeans, in terms of military commitment, unless they really have to do it and they know they can do it successfully, such as British and French intervention in Libya, mm-hmm. they're not going to mess around with in the Baltic region militarily or with Putin. And I'm sure he knows that.
Well, we're going to turn to President Obama and a couple of important victories he has. But first, let's take another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back. Anyway, I'm Fred Barnes with David Rennie and Abdurrahim Fukara. It was an odd coalition that is now producing American support for this trade treaty, which obviously, I mean, the initial thing here was getting something that sets up a vote for the treaty, which hasn't been finally negotiated, but will be soon. And the treaty would be meaningless without the United States being a part of it, this treaty involving Pacific powers, Japan, Malaysia, Chile, Canada, and others, 12 countries in all. But it was an odd coalition. It was the Democratic president and the Republicans in the House and the Senate.
Well, we've seen this before with trade deals. I mean, you know, the left of the Democratic Party is, you know, in the pockets of the trade unions, the labor unions. They basically hate trade deals because they think that more trade is inevitably going to hurt Americans. You know, you can make a case that this is politics as it's meant to work. There was a bipartisan mm-hmm. agreement. You had the president and centrist Democrats agreeing with the leadership and the establishment of the Republican Party. And then you had the fringes on the left and the right unable to muster enough numbers finally to stop it. And they did a deal. I mean, it's actually how politics is meant to work. I think what's striking is if you look back at, say, previous big trade deals that Bill Clinton signed, the NAFTA North American yep. deal in the 90s, when he did that deal, he managed to get 102 or 103, I think it was, Democrats in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, compared to 28.
Him, down to 28. Mm-hmm. I suspect, you know, people say, oh, Obama doesn't play enough golf with these guys, and on the margins, that's true. But the other big thing is if you look at the 102 who voted for trade 20 years ago, the difference is a lot of those districts have now gone Republican. Mm-hmm. I mean, just politics is much, much more polarized. There are fewer centrist, moderate sort of districts around now.
Well, I was around in 1993 when NAFTA passed, and I'll have to say President Clinton put together a lobbying effort that was much stronger than President Obama's. But the result is going to be the same. It's going to be Republicans and a smaller number of Democrats passing this treaty. How important is this treaty?
For the Obama administration, at least, I think it's extremely important. He is an administration that for the last 5-6 years has been talking about the pivot to Asia and has been virtually completely unable to do it.
You know who really cares about this, of course, are these Asian countries.
Well, but here in the U.S., he obviously has a big stake in saying, well, I've been talking about the Asia pivot for the last 6 years. The Middle East has prevented me from going there. But at least now I see some light at the end of the tunnel. I can pull this off, and I can remind people that for Asians and Americans, this treaty is very, very important, and it's doable. And I've even managed to pull it off after the election season has started in the U.S. with this kind of bipartisan support. The Iranians, for example, have circled back to the Iranians. Mm-hmm. One fear that they've had is that Congress is so divided, and if Obama concludes a deal, what happens with Congress in the next administration? Will it be able to uphold the agreement? Well, now he can, in the same way that he did with Cuba, he can tell the outside world, look, even at this difficult time, mm-hmm. despite the lack of enough bipartisanship, I have been able to do something very important with Asia.
You know, I talked to Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and he said talking to President Obama after the crucial vote was, he said it was like an out-of-body experience, because here he's talking on the phone to President Obama, who's criticizing Democrats for voting against it, for not being on his side. And then the White House was quoted in the New York Times as saying, they dealt better with Republicans on this deal, more professionally, than they have in their dealings with Democrats on other issues, particularly Harry Reid,
who is the
Democratic leader in the Senate.
The left of the Democratic Party behaved absolutely disgracefully in this deal. And if you want to really depress yourselves, Abdurrahim is totally right. You know, if they had not got this deal done, it would have sent an unbelievably damaging signal to Asia and the rest of the world that America was disengaging, that this president couldn't get anything done. I mean, they had public warnings from Asian governments that this was, you know, the absolute kind of peak of dysfunction. What I found unbelievably depressing was that those geopolitical arguments completely did not resonate among Democrats in the House. They didn't care. They wanted to talk about the Highway Trust Fund, crumbling bridges in Hoboken.
Right.
You know, I mean, it is the most navel-gazing, narcissistic kind of internal debate about the Democratic Party. And Hillary Clinton, who should know better, who used to talk about this trade deal for its geopolitical importance, totally shamed herself by being initially silent and then somewhat sort of skeptical about this trade deal. She really, really, really did let herself down this week.
I know the Australians really care about this, because I heard from a friend of mine in Australia shortly after this, Tom Switzer, who's the editor of the Australian edition of The Spectator, the British conservative magazine. So there are a lot of countries that were looking forward to this, and I know we're going to be pleased by it. In the minutes we have left, let's talk about what happened by the Supreme Court. In the Health Care Act, Obamacare it's called, even by President Obama now, the National Health Insurance Act, there was a question of whether the federal government was entitled to provide subsidies for poor people who really couldn't afford health insurance. It was a 6-3 victory for Obama that they can do this in the Supreme Court. I kind of expected it, but I know there were an awful lot of conservatives and Republicans who thought that the Supreme Court was going to deny this right to the Obama administration.
Well, essentially, conservatives were playing gotcha with some bad drafting. It's a complicated thing, but to simplify it a great deal, a whole bunch of states, more than 30 states, most of them Republican, disliked this law so much that they chose not really to get involved in delivering subsidies to poor people. So the federal government stepped in, gave these subsidies, but the language of the law itself was ambiguous as to whether the federal government had the right to do that. It was missing.
I don't know that it was ambiguous. It said they had to be.
It said who could provide subsidies through the state exchanges.
Yeah.
Other bits of the law made it clear that the people receiving these subsidies were covered by the federal. Anyway, I think if you want to understand really what the Supreme Court has now twice done, that a conservative Supreme Court has twice now rejected conservative attacks on President Obama's law. I think what we're doing is conservatives have been saying this is rogue law. This is unlawful statute. Twice now, this Supreme Court has said, no, we disagree. We're not going to go down that path. Fight this out using the usual political congressional methods. But if you want to come and say, strike down this whole law as an attack on the Constitution, we're not going to go there. Fundamentally, Congress voted on this. It came through the normal parts. I think that's what this is about.
You've explained it very well. The Supreme Court, at least a majority, is very leery of striking down what Congress has done.
I'm sure that to a lot of your listeners in other parts of the world, which don't have a health system to, you know, mention, I'm sure a lot of people in those regions are scratching their heads and saying, what are the Americans talking about? This president wants to extend health coverage to everyone in the U.S., but there are people who are saying no, and now the Supreme Court has to step in. What some of these people don't understand is obviously that this is very important for Americans, because it goes to the heart of the American system, individual responsibility, and, you know, who should foot the bill for whose health care. At the end of the day, together with a possible agreement with Iran, I think this may go down as a signature achievement for the Obama administration, despite all the criticism that he's incurring up to this point in time.
I think one more step is necessary to lock in this law, and that is election of a Democratic president in 2016. If that happens, the fight will be over. If a Republican wins, I guess the fight will continue, I think, with some intensity. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief, Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.